Welcome to Windows into Eternity with Almeen. This hour you will receive powerful revelations of a world where mystery and miracles are commonplace. Here's your host, Almeen.
Welcome to Windows into Eternity, understanding the concepts of ascension. This is Almeen, and I'm delighted that you could join us today. This is a weekly show in which we attempt to make a little clearer the wonderfully exciting concepts surrounding the possibility, and indeed the very real probability, that humankind can eventually live a deathless life wherein the purification rite of death is no longer needed, and wherein ascension takes place of the body. What exactly is ascension? Ascension is the vibrating of the body at such a high frequency, having the cells filled with the three primary ascension attitudes of love, praise, and gratitude as a permanent frequency. And when that is the case, only so much light can be held until a being has to transfigure. The transfiguration that happens as we go through the three phases of ascension is in fact the transfiguration of the emotional bodies during the God consciousness stage that precedes ascension, and the mental bodies during the actual stages of ascension. As the fields around the body transform and transfigure, ultimately, the body has to follow. And the body is never again the same. Even deep cuts produce very little blood, and in fact, the blood is only there if we expect it. Food becomes obsolete after the second phase of ascended mastery, which is immortality. And this is possible when not only the fields have transfigured, but we live in eternal time. We have in previous ages had the option to vibrate the body right out of this frequency into a frequency beyond, which is the mastery, the ascended mastery realm. It's also called the Brotherhood of White Light, the Ascended Masters, etc. But it has recently become necessary that some of the Ascended Masters remain in physical form, living day by day human lives. And the reason for that is that it is necessary to create a pulsation between activity and beingness, between doingness and beingness, between the masculine proactive pole and the feminine receptive pole within the kingdom of ascended masters of all races. Ultimately, ascension brings very expanded vision. And up until 2005, the ascended masters had been very overpolarized into the light, which is the known. But it is embodiment in the flesh where the known and the unknown meet. And so it was the request of the divine, of the infinite mother who gave life to all things, including the infinite father as her first creation. It was at that time that the mother wanted a polarity to exist to bring new life force back to the ascended mastery realms so that once again it can flow with life and energy and power and strength. The ascended masters that then went into ascension were asked if they would please stay in physical form and not vibrate out of physicality into those realms so that the ascended mastery could be also accessing the unknown, which, as I pointed out, is only able to be done while in the flesh. This has brought tremendous vitality back to the Ascended Mastery Realms. And in fact, for the first time, Ascended Masters since 2005 have been able to procreate, to fall in love. They were actually given the right to procreate, but no one took the Infinite Mother's gift and actually utilized it, because it was very emotionless in their state of expanded being. And so she has given them the ability. The more and more physical Ascended Masters occurred, the more the grid of the Ascended Masters became one in which emotions were felt, and now they have the ability to fall in love. Another great change that took place in 2005 in relation to the Ascended Mastery Realms had to do with the spirit world. Up until that time, the spirit world was divided into two sections, Duat, which is the lower one, and Sekhet Hepsbet, which are the Egyptian terms for the lower and the upper spirit realms. And it was necessary for spirits of humans, for example, that die, to come back into embodiment to become ascended masters. But at that time, what occurred is that Mother flung open the gates that separated the spirit realms, the spirit worlds, from the upper realms above them, which was the Ascended Mastery Realms. I remember that the guardian at that time of that gate was Ratmatora Ma'atmaset, was his name. He was the Lord of Great Light, and he was the guardian of the gate. And Mother instructed him to open the gate. The huge difference this has made is that not a few months later, the first four spirits actually ascended from spirit world directly into the Ascended Mastery Realms. So this is now available to us spirits. They don't have to incarnate. They can go straight there. Now, to our beloved listeners, we have today with us Paul St. John, who is my very dear friend and also the office manager of Spiritual Journeys in the Newport, Oregon branch. So, Paul, welcome, and I am under the understanding that you have prepared some wonderful questions for us about these issues surrounding the wonderful destiny of man, which is Ascended Mastery.
Absolutely, Almeen. And I can start with just clarifying some of the things that you've already spoken about. Like, for example, immortality. I was wondering if you could expand a little bit more on what immortality is.
The Ascended Mastery is the final big stage of the human evolution. Beyond that, there's a whole other kingdom that lies waiting for us, which is the God Kingdom. But the last big stage of human evolution is Ascended Mastery. We have ego identification, then we have God consciousness, then we have Ascended Mastery. The first phase, because it has three phases, the first phase is, in fact, the phase of the totally silent mind. It's the place where all speaking, all writing, everything is done without pre-thinking what it is you will say or write. My books are written that way. I write them longhand from total stillness of mind. Most of my speaking is done that way. The mind is only utilized for analysis, and even deduction gives way to effortless knowing. The second phase is, in fact, the phase of Ascended Mastery's immortality. And what that is about, it's a very deeply, deeply blissful stage. And it is the middle one of the three that make up Ascended Mastery. The bliss that you experience there is incredibly deep. And if there is not a cessation of activity, because that stage to be vital enough, then regeneration happens more rapidly than destructuring of cells in the body. It doesn't mean we don't destructure. It just means because we have totally relinquished our will to that of the highest good, and that safeguards the well-being of the interconnectedness of life, meaning that the life is no longer self-centered, but instead totally inclusive. At that point, the regeneration of cells speed up. There is a specific cell in the pineal gland called the life cell. It starts to emit the life hormone. And there is a vast change that takes place in the energy levels. Sleep is less. You just don't need it that much. You don't need to eat that much. And then the deep, deep bliss is constantly in the cells. The temptation to succumb to inactivity is very big. But if you do, there's not enough energy available to regenerate the cells more rapidly than the destructuring of the body takes place. And so the body has to be in eternal time, because
that was my next question.
Oh, okay. Well, let me have you phrase it properly then.
Well, no, you were right about to head into the exact question I was going to ask, which was how eternal time supports this, supports maintaining the regeneration more rapidly than the destructuring.
Well, eternal time means that there are no constrictions in the flow of life force. Linear time will create constrictions. So that, let's say it's in the fear center. Let's say there is fear that you don't run your business as well because you're so expanded. If there is any fear like that, it will manifest approximately 2 inches below the belly button. That will create a blockage in the flow of prana or chi or life force that goes up and down the pranic tube. That will cause energy to leak out the lower pole, which is meaning that the energy leaks towards the earth. And it leaks out the root chakra because it can't properly move upward. When it actually leaks out the root chakra, you become subject to gravitation rather than the law of levitation. Levitation helps you loosen. Gravitation will gather unto itself dust to dust and etc. So it's the cause of death.
Yes, that's quite something. I don't think many of us have heard of that other pole of gravitation, of the law of levitation. That's quite, thank you for sharing that with us, Almeen.
And for example, you know, how I mentioned in our introduction, the love, the praise, and the gratitude. The love, the praise, and the gratitude will put you into states of levitation.
Well, why don't you talk more about those? Because it sounds like those are very important concepts of ascension.
Okay, you know, could I actually go a little deeper into levitation?
Oh, absolutely.
And then, if you will, would you remind me again to come back to love, praise, and gratitude? Because there's something I have not frequently explained that I think our listeners might be fascinated by.
Great.
And that is this issue of linear time and how it puts us into gravitation. But you know, Paul, I think we're at about the time we should take a quick commercial break. So, folks, stay with us, and when you come back, we will be delighted to talk further with Paul St. John, and we will at that time tell you about levitation and why it is that you have to be in eternal time for it.
The brand new book, The Gift of the Unicorns, is now available from Al Mean. The magical book answers the question, do mystical creatures like the winged horse Pegasus, mermaids, and giants truly exist? What is their roles, and how can they be called upon for assistance? In their own words, the unicorns reveal where they went during the ages of darkness, their heroism in preserving purity and innocence, their golden shoes, and the secret mission they undertook for the mother of all creation. To receive your copy of this amazing book of sacred secrets, The Gift of the Unicorns, go to www.spiritualjourneys.com or call 502-499-0016 today. A Life of Miracles is a deeply inspiring and motivational book in its content. It is unique in its field in making man's relationship as the microcosm to the macrocosm understandable to both beginning and advanced readers. It's a detailed guide to living a joyous and balanced life that provides a carefully laid out map to achieving the magnificent destiny that beckons at the apex of human experience, that of ascension. If you're ready to ascend to a higher consciousness, begin each day with A Life of Miracles or any other books, CDs, lectures, workshops, or her magazine by contacting Al Mean at www.spiritualjourneys.com.
To Windows into Eternity, Understanding Concepts of Ascension. When one is in a mode in which immortality and ascension can take place, there is a meridian in the body that lies like a figure eight vertically. Its crossing over point is in the life force center. When this is the case, the life force center feeds the body continually. The life force center used to be behind the belly button of all beings, but the Infinite Mother has in the last months of 2007 moved that life force center up into the heart center. So now, that figure eight, vertically, the loop above and the loop below, cross over at the heart in the life force center. This life force center is fed by the source of all life. It is connected to the infinite being. When we start to resist life, thoughts arise in the quietness of the mind. When this happens, we start to live either in the next moment or the one before, and linear time arises as well. When this happens, this figure eight that should be completely vertical in the case of someone with totally silent mind starts to tilt. And eventually, in someone that is totally living in linear time with an internal dialogue of mind, it is lying horizontally. And it goes with the loop of the future before us and the loop of the past behind us. And now we would end up living in our own made linear time. It is then that energy line is fully able to be subject to gravity. Our bodies become subject to gravity, and then the destructuring of the cells go more rapidly than it would to regenerate the cells. So, Paul, welcome back with us, and please continue with your questions.
Well, Almin, I would really like to know how a little bit more about love, praise, and gratitude as attitudes, ascension attitudes, which help increase this access to levitation and eternal time and immortality, and help decrease the effects of gravity on us.
And would you take just a moment and tell the folks what that is, in terms of what an attitude is?
Well, it's definitely, we call them the ascension attitudes, and they are a combination of, I believe, an emotion and a perception and you would probably be better at describing how they relate, Almeen. I know that they look like a wobbly frog.
I can't stand it. I have to put you on the spot at least once every show, Paul. Just to keep you on your toes. Well, let's start in. The attitudes of love, praise, and gratitude are representative of the Trinity that one finds throughout the matrix of existence. They are the crowning glory of a sanctified life. They are the vehicle to the immortality and ascension that await us beyond this present horizon. So let's break this up, and now I'm going to do quite a bit of talking, if that's okay, Paul, unless you have a question, and just pop right in.
Okay.
Emerson wrote something that I find very interesting. He said, "Alas, I know not why. Each man sees over his own experience a certain stain of error, whilst that of other men looks fair and ideal." And you know, the reason we look back with so much regret at what we regard as our folly is that the memory of our higher levels of consciousness lies not far submerged beneath the surface mind. We suppress with pain the memory of the faces we once loved, and guilt taints many of the choices we have made in our lives. But this really dishonors the journey of our lives. By not acknowledging the worth of our seeming errors as our great teachers of wisdom, remove one failed relationship or one silly choice, and one would also have to remove as much wisdom and insight. But nowhere does the sting of self-censure torture us more than in the memories of love lost or misplaced. The word love, you know, we hear it from pulpits, across restaurant tables, in flowery Valentine cards, in all sorts of places. But the fact is that very few philosophers have shed much light on how the love we feel in romance and the love for the infinite and creation can be reconciled. Romantic love is either extolled in its very abundant sources of literature, or the more spiritual writings dismiss it as an unworthy reflection of this infinite love. But the result of this dichotomy is that because romantic love is the most intoxicating feeling most humans will ever have, I think the philosophers call it the enchantment of human life, the guilt is compounded by feeling that such intense love should instead have been given to God. In the lives of most, no love will ever again compare to the runaway romantic emotion of youth. And so we find ourselves lacking in devotion, and so try to love God by stirring up a fervor, all the fervor we can, but it remains sort of a nebulous and undefined concept. This often creates those religious fanatics, I'm sure we've all met one, who, failing in their feelings, try to compensate through their actions. So we've got to look at this. It's actually the very turbulence of our romantic love that carves out of our souls the hollows that will hold a greater love. It's through our love for a lover, a father, a mother, a child, that love grows to include all people. So like the stormiest seas carve the deepest caverns in the cliffs, so too the most painful memories create our deepest capacity for love. And if I can just give this one little example really quickly. My mother spent her last years in an old age home in a little town 15 hours by car from where I live. I tried to have her moved to where our family could give her attention and care, but the doctors felt she might suffer a fatal heart attack from the stress of the move. So the difficulty in reaching her, and later on, she couldn't even remember us when we phoned, had her die miles from her loved ones, surrounded by strangers, and the pain and guilt of feeling I had failed her arose often in my heart for many years. It has deepened my ability to love older people, and constant silent blessings and healings flow from me when I encounter an older person and know they're someone's mother or father. So same with romantic love. The intenseness of it awakens within us the ability to love others more deeply. But it also awakens so much more. The depth an artist brings to art likewise stems from passion inspired by love. Eventually, not only that which we create, but that which we are gets formed and shaped into a maturity that is lacking in those who have never relinquished the love of self for love of another. And so, just to conclude on this issue of love as a major ascension attitude, we learn through our earthly loves how to surrender to something greater, that one day we may merge with our own higher identity. And that identity is being as vast as the cosmos, having a human experience. We find through love's muse, the poet within us, the spontaneity of the inner child. We remember once again what it is like to follow our hearts and abandon reason. Love mellows us and reduces our resistance to life. And as we grow older, what we forfeit in intensity, we gain in inclusiveness. The qualities of inclusiveness and surrender prepare us for God consciousness. And here we encounter the silence of the mind. The heart cannot fully love while there is an internal dialogue, though one can only know that retrospectively. As the mind silences, the heart bursts open with an all-encompassing, melting tenderness for life. Divine love has taken its place on the throne of our heart. Now, Paul, I didn't actually cover praise and gratitude. Did you want me to go into that as well?
Well, if it's even half, if your descriptions of praise and gratitude are even half as beautiful as yours of love, then I think we probably should.
Thank you. That's very beautifully said. Thank you very much. Well, let's start with praise. So, when I was a child, I had a fear of heights. When on the high rise of the carnival or perched way up in our mulberry tree, I found that I could overcome it by focusing on the far horizon. So by slightly altering the focus of my eyes, the heights just became friendlier. Praise is like that. Praise is an attitude that focuses on the distant horizons and allows itself to enjoy the breathtaking view. It acknowledges that there is an unpaid bill, but focuses instead on the nurturing and abundant supply that flows to one who trusts in it. It does not disassociate from the cares of today, but rather sees them in their true context as bringers of growth. Praise is an attitude of thoughts raised heavenwards. Nowhere can one see it better than the story of Christ walking on the water, as it's told in the New Testament. He did not focus on the stormy seas. He kept his focus on indwelling life rather than form. The disciple Peter, on the other hand, who wished to walk on the water also, saw the billowing waves and the high winds and sank beneath the water. The master had to reach forth his hand and save him. The one lived in a state of praise. Peter did not. States of praise have been employed for eons by those that have been made holy by association. So it's as an ascension attitude. It needs to be tempered by experience. It's not enough to withdraw from life, to spend our days singing songs of praise to the infinite. We are here first and foremost to explore the unknown, and any attempt at escaping what we have undertaken to do carries with it a penalty, to shirk our duty and our highest calling in favor of retreating into ecstatic states of praise, yields a form of praise that's not tested and strong. That which has been sheltered is seldom robust, for it has not been honed by experience, nor is it polished by the high luster that only adversity can give. It's easy to feel praise in a sanctuary, but can behind the perfection, hidden behind the appearances in the time-ravaged faces of the beggars lining a city street. There's no redundancy in the cosmos. If there's a beggar in the street, there's also the need for him to be there. Is it the result of his consistently avoiding his next step that such painful forced change is his lot? Or is it perhaps that he is solving a profound portion of the mystery of beingness that requires such a drastic mirror of that which the infinite is not? It could be that a great master has undertaken to play this role, to either shed light where there is despair, or to give us the opportunity for compassionate understanding. Whatever the reason may be, there will be ample cause for praise if we change our focus from appearances to indwelling life. So in closing, praise fills the cells with light, and our footsteps become a blessing to the earth. All life we touch responds with increased growth to such a life-affirming frequency. Filled with praise, we also become filled with increased light and life force. And then in the twinkling of an eye, the lightning flash of immortality changes us into an ascended master. Paul, if you want me to tackle the gratitude, think about it, or if you have other questions you wanted to ask, but let's take a quick break for our commercials.
In this, the fourth book, The Ring of Truth, which chronicles Almeen's journey, she tells of the promise and the potential inherent in the resurgence of the feminine principle, increasingly felt in all aspects of current human experience. The operation of new laws governing the cosmos are explained together with the reasons for their creation. We are introduced to Mother, the primal creative energy that pervades every aspect of existence. We learn of her love and her laws and how to incorporate them into every thought and act. We are given samples of her divine language, its meaning, and its power. Mother's great gift to humanity, the healing power of Belvaspada, is revealed. This new approach to dissolving disease of mind, spirit, and body replaces previously existing methodologies. Application of its techniques removes old barriers of physically oriented existence and opens a broad pathway to a life of joy and fulfillment. Discover Mother and the Ring of Truth, as well as all of Almeen's books, CDs, lectures, workshops, or magazine by logging on to www.spiritualjourneys.com. The Complete Power Of and the Mystical Keys series of radio programs are a part of the Premier CD set. They are available from Almeen at www.spiritualjourneys.com. Request the entire Premier CD series set or the new book, Aruba Farina, The Book of Fairy Magic, by calling 502-499-0016 today.
Welcome back to this segment of Windows into Eternity, Understanding Concepts of Ascension. We have with us Paul St. John, who is my office manager in the Newport branch of Spiritual Journeys. And Paul, what would be the next question? Did you want me to tackle gratitude, or would you like to go to anything else?
No, I think it's very important for people to hear you describe gratitude. That would be ideal, okay. I think.
All right, because it's our third ascension attitude.
Yes.
The previous attitudes of love and praise and this attitude of gratitude, any one of them continually engaged in for even a few weeks will change the body from mortal to immortal. So, gratitude, if true happiness lies in being happy with what we have, rather than being happy when we get what we want, gratitude is, in fact, then, the key to happiness. It helps us value the little joys of the moment, rather than to wait for the large windfalls. And in doing so, we learn to appreciate life. Life consists of the small treasures, like the quiet oasis of the undisturbed moment with a cup of tea or coffee that allows us to return to the inner world of contemplation. Life is the succession of the footsteps of time for us to make of them what we want to. We can either turn them into the weary tread of drudgery or lighten their gait with gratitude. The cherishing warmth of a favorite quilt on a dark, rain-drenched night like here in Oregon. The moment of feeling the coming of spring in the air. The rosy-cheeked pleasure of rocking my little girl to sleep, her eyelids weighted by the adventures of her day. All these treasured moments through awareness become ample reason for a heart to brim with gratitude. Not only does gratitude bless us with joy, but also with increase. One of the most concealed laws of supply is that gratitude opens the floodgates of heaven, increasing anything it focuses on. Would we wish to increase our health, our abundance, and our abilities? Then the place to begin is in grateful acknowledgement of whatever we already have. Instead of seeing how small the supply is, let's focus on appreciation and joy, on how much it means to have it. With each dollar we spend, with sincere, heartfelt gratitude, many more will find their way into our pocket. Like the other ascension attitudes, gratitude is very life-affirming to all who come in contact with it. Indigenous peoples have always known that nature responds favorably to gratitude, that species thrive and evolve under the grateful recognition of man. Gratitude sanctifies not only the giver, but also the recipient. So the true testing of a grateful heart is found in the challenges that life brings. Inclusiveness demands that gratitude, like the sun or the life-giving rain, does not deem one as worthy and another as not, but shed its radiance on pain and pleasure alike. It takes in-depth insight to probe behind the appearances and extract that eternal truth that the infinite sends nothing but goodness. She sends either gifts, and this also applies to the Father, sends either gifts or challenges, but challenges are themselves gifts in disguise, and so they're therefore worthy of our gratitude. When this principle is applied, it will soon become apparent that the faintest glimmer of gratitude from the heart begins to unravel the illusion concealing the gift of insight challenges can hold. If we can master the ability to be grateful in all circumstances, the transfiguring power of gratitude will shine forth, changing the cells of the body into spiritualized matter. And so we become what humankind is truly meant to be, ascended masters.
Wow. Thank you, Elmeen.
You're welcome.
Can you continue on? This is a really wonderful description of these very important concepts for ascension. I'm wondering if we can just continue on the way this is going, and maybe you could address the 7 supporting ascension attitudes. They're written about, I recall, in Journey to the Heart of God, your 2nd book, and they are reverence, self-reliance, calmness or poise, failure, time, generosity, and grace. And I thought we might not have enough time to tackle them all this show, but if you could start with reverence and maybe go one by one and give a description to our listeners what those entail.
All right. And, you know, something that folks puzzle about as well is that one that's called failure.
Yes, I can imagine.
You know, because they're wondering what it's about, but it's the issue of failing successfully, and it might be a better thing to call it. But let's just give a brief summary of what these 7 supporting attitudes are,
okay,
and then we'll start in with reverence. The 7 supporting attitudes that he's speaking of is an active part in someone's life, and when that person has mastered him or herself. no longer can such one be pulled out of the center of his or her circle by the occurrences of daily life. Such a master welcomes pain as well as joy, and sees in pain but another opportunity to triumph over resistance to life, to relinquish the desires of the ego upon the altar of indwelling life while affirming, "Thy will be done." So running through these supporting attitudes is the golden thread of deep, abiding respect for the divinity within all lives. They harbor respect for our inner guidance, for the way we spend our moments, for the mixture of folly and wisdom that belies the greater destiny of our fellow man. They bring a respect for the process of life, unfolding so that demands that we live life well. So let's begin with reverence. Reverence stems actually from the ability to see the divine within form. And it also enhances that ability. So it's like a circle. They feed each other, you see. So in the moment when the heavens reveal themselves through the eyes of a child or unfurl with the dew soft petals of a beautiful rose, or a reverent response arises in our hearts. So to the eyes of profanity, the doors concealing the divine remain closed. Whereas the more we approach life prepared to be awe-inspired, the more we shall be. If there are parts of creation we exclude from our reverence, let's look a little deeper. And there, too, we can find abundant reasons for seeing the perfection of indwelling life. Some revere the beauty of the flowers in their garden, but shun the weeds. The virulence of life and the determination to survive found in the weeds is a true testimony to the universal law that we strengthen that which we oppose. So it's often easier to feel reverence for nature or the genius reflected in the work of man's hands than for our fellow man. The reverence may not appear at all unless we learn at last to embrace the value of their folly. The grandest of souls assigned the task of solving the most ambitious part of the mystery of beingness might just seem at times more foolish than the complacent person who stays in the safety of the known. So perhaps we sanctimoniously think it is our duty as a light promoter to withhold our recognition of the value of what Lucifer and his hosts of darkness did to embody chaos. But without them, wouldn't we have then had to embody it? They embodied it so that it would not spill throughout the population. Reverence leaves the mark of refinement upon the one who makes it a way of life. Refinement is often misunderstood as belonging to one who is educated or steeped in culture, but it belongs as much to the farmer who kneels in the mud, cradling the newborn lamb tenderly with work-worn hands. It is the hallmark of one who recognizes the infinite value of life as the embodiment of the infinite. I can no more spit on the ground than I can in the face of another, for while in states of expanded awareness, I have seen the true glory of the earth. I've seen that the very dirt upon which we stand glows with a light more beautiful than the most breathtaking sunset. I know that every blade of grass shares my reverence for life. Scientists have measured a response, I think it's in the little book called The Secret Life of Plants, that can only be described as a silent scream in plants when a fly is killed in their vicinity. The answer to pollution and poverty and homelessness is not more technology. It's reverence for the purposes of indwelling life in order to cooperate with it. Light promoters tend to want to save and fix. This still judges and divides. Whereas acknowledging wholeness heals. Please bear with us. It's a few moments of commercials, and we will be right back.
After 3 months of intense physical preparation in January 2004, Almin experienced a transfiguration, entering the presence of the infinite for the second time since moving into God consciousness, the state of no longer identifying with the ego, in 2000. In the weeks that followed, the powerful revelations contained in this book emerged from that all-encompassing silence. Having lost most of her linear thinking during this transition, much of this book had been written without conscious thought. This form of automatic writing, like automatic speaking she now does, flows freely from source into her own handwriting from which it was transcribed. Few have entered into God consciousness to leave the bliss to teach. Still fewer enter the stage of immortal master, and in addition, continue to function among the masses. But as a Toltec Nagual and seer, Almin's life is dedicated to leading others to complete freedom from mortal boundaries. Journey to the Heart of God is an opportunity of a lifetime to see through the eyes of one who has encountered the indescribable realms of eternity. From such a perspective come insights that can heal the deepest wounds of alienation found in human hearts. Journey to the Heart of God contains, no matter how profound, truth. Truth that can be recognized for what it is, and it is the truth that shall set us free. Pick up a copy of The Journey to the Heart of God and discover your personal truth and freedom through Almin's books, CDs, workshops, lectures, and magazine by logging on to www.spiritualjourneys.com.
Welcome back to Windows into Eternity. And Paul St. John and I are discussing the seven supporting attitudes. And, Paul, what was the next one that you wanted me to tackle, my friend?
It would be self-reliance.
All right, let's go to self-reliance, one of our ascension attitudes. So, Emerson actually wrote a beautiful essay on self-reliance that's well worth reading, but great gains in self-reliance have been made during the last 25 to 30 years. And this is in large part as the result of an escalating destructuring of family life. For every loss, there is a gain. And in this instance, both men and women have been plunged into single-parent units where they have had to play many roles and often find at the end of a weary day that the only nurturing afforded them will have to be self-nurturing. Furthermore, there's no one to fight their battles, and after bitter lessons, they may also be fortunate enough to stumble onto the great truth that has separated genius from mediocrity, that no one can advise us on a course of action, not even the angels themselves. They can only illuminate eternal truths as guiding lights upon our way. Our paths are unique only to us, and lie on an uncharted course, and the compass is found in the higher wisdom whispered through the promptings of our hearts. And then suddenly one day, a starkly revealed truth emerges, and we realize that our being is our sustenance. Such a realization is indeed the very foundation of self-reliance. It's only the beginning, however, for the edifice to be built upon it takes the painstaking effort of casting off the enslavement of social conditioning and laying the bricks of original thought, moment by luminous moment. Original thought doesn't ask whether the world can understand it, for its origin is the heart of God, and to enter there, linear and superficial thought must be left at the gate. I think it was Rumi that said that the one who cannot hear the music thinks the dancer is mad. The world wallows in conformity and society favors mediocrity over greatness. To ask for either its understanding or its approval is to sound the death knell to originality. The ego who has seen the whole valley from the higher thermals above, attempting to mingle with the flocks of birds on the ground, would find only at rejection. For the pigeons know that in the presence of the eagle, their own lack of sight is made all the more apparent. So, relinquishing either the need to please or the need to have others conform to our expectations creates a sovereignty and peace of mind. It would be as though, instead of walking around with an umbilical cord that we're trying to plug into another, we were to plug it back into ourselves. We would find ourselves then as our own source of strength and nurturing, self-supporting and self-referring for approval. To such a one, life may bring what it will, for nothing can rob or erode their greatest treasure, the peace of mind inner sovereignty brings. So, Paul, that's about it for self-reliance, and what else did you want us to mention?
Well, thank you for that, Almeen. That was a beautiful description of self-reliance. And it seems like these very much just blend right into each other. I'm wondering if you can move into what you describe as calmness or poise.
Yes, I certainly can. The calm poise detected in Masters of Power is the culmination of a lifetime of discipline and the unconditional surrender to the unfolding of life. It's the crowning glory of a life well lived, a life in which the larger vision was the determining factor rather than a focus on the vicissitudes or the back and forths of everyday life. When we observe, say from a mountaintop, the journey of a bicycle in the valley below, it may appear as a straight course, but nothing can be further from the truth. The bicycle moves slightly left, then right, and back again, constantly. If we hold the larger vision in our lives, the daily to's and fro's appear inconsequential. Calmness replaces attempts to control the inevitable instabilities that are inherent in the journey. If there are times when the rageful onslaught of another can easily throw us off the balance we have worked so hard to achieve, then we have already conceded defeat. The eagle, for example, it's the mortal enemy of the heron. We have both here in Newport, Oregon. And naturalists have seen attacks by an eagle on the heron in which the heron stood in perfect stillness and poise, beak pointed at the sky. The eagle, in a dive of ferocious speed and focused intent, in these instances, impaled himself on the heron's beak. Should we still be the targets of another's rage? Let us stand just like the heron, in the majesty of calmness, never leaving the center of our circle. It may become clear that universal energy conspires to assist the one who stands in strength and poise far more readily than the one who plays the part of a helpless victim. The essence of calmness is to not anticipate or control life, but instead to let life come to us. So too with those who are our teachers disguised as our enemies. By all means, prepare for the worst, for to be taken by surprise drains energy. But having done so, we have earned the right to expect the best. Under the gaze of calmness, the absence of luster in the lives of our opponents becomes apparent. The only power they find they can muster is a destructive one, and thus they can only peck at the object of their discomfort in an attempt to reduce him to their level. Calmness and poise are tested by interaction and adversity, but it is fed by solitude. If solitude is the price of greatness, I would gladly pay, and should I chafe under the burden of it, I would remind myself of the alternative, a life lived in the half-light, enslaved by approval and condemned to beg for alms of well-being from another. We study and quote the great ones of history. But instead, if we value the inspiration of the divine within, we shall join the ranks of those great ones in history. So that's it for calmness and poise.
Wow. Thank you, Almeen. And now for the one that seems most confusing to people, we'll call it failing well.
Okay. Failing successfully or well can be defined perhaps in this way. A day without failure is a day without growth. That is a Native American saying. And our battle in life is not against outside circumstances. After all, one strengthens that which one opposes. The true battle of a light promoter is against illusion. Every encounter with opposition is a chance to pierce the illusion and find the hidden perception. In that case, how can we really ever fail? So to put it more clearly, the man in the street who tries to triumph without learning a thing has everything to lose and nothing to gain. If he ends up being right in his mind, he has triumphed. All he has really managed to do, as he tries to force his belief systems onto others or circumstances, is to thicken the prison bars that keep him locked in his worldview. Because the light promoter knows that his being is his sustenance, he is unconcerned by others' opinion of him. Thus he has nothing to prove and everything to learn. Because his inner nurturer, which is one of the subpersonalities we frequently speak of, is parenting his inner child, and his inner warrior protects his inner family, and the inner sage guides those inner pieces, he doesn't ever have to live up to the expectations of others. He has ceased to need. His internal family is alive and well. So we become self-referring for approval. And so we can sit back and enjoy the success of learning from our mistakes, becoming more and more filled with light. The most common mistake made when confronted with a challenge is to measure it against past experience. And thus, we are led into believing we have identified it and labeled it. To avoid this, there are actually four steps that I usually recommend that we use in order to avoid strengthening the old belief systems and failing to grasp the insights from experience. And we have just a minute, and I'll just quickly give them to folks. We don't back away from a challenge if it's ours to tackle. If we still have something to learn, and we'll know that by our knee-jerk reactions, it's ours. Secondly, we know that there's far more to this challenge than just its initial appearance. We take time to see behind the appearances. And then thirdly, we remind ourselves that we are really working on our destiny. And our destiny is to live fully from our heart and find as many new ways as we can to reflect that which is. The infinite being of purity, love, and light. We realize, and this is number four, that we created this challenge. We did so by carefully manifesting outside circumstances to learn our next insight. And we further remember that the solution has to benefit the indwelling life of everyone involved. If we fail to learn our lessons, others who have contracted to mirror certain things to us get trapped on the treadmill with us. Living our highest truth always benefits all. So once again, the key to successfully living these principles depends on our inclusiveness, seeing the large picture. The following words by President Woodrow Wilson that I'm about to speak to you summarizes it, and we'll end it with that. He said, "I would rather fail in a cause I know one day will triumph than triumph in a cause that I know one day will fail." If our eyes are fixed on the big picture, we don't mind the short-term failures. So, Paul, I so appreciate where you've guided us with this, with your interview. And we are now actually at the end of our time. So we would love for you to join us again next week on Windows into Eternity, Understanding Concepts of Ascension. Thank you for being our light family. It is your listening to us that encourages us to bring forth higher truths. Thank you and many blessings.
We hope you've enjoyed today's show, Windows into Eternity with Al Mean. Please join us again next week.